Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. Think how far and how fast technology has advanced. Just a century and a half ago, the fastest way we could communicate in this country with each other was by Pony Express. Then came the telegraph, telephones, and then computers, which have become more and more powerful, revolutionizing in just a few decades the way we live, the way we work and play.
In 1997, the IBM computer Big Blue outplayed chess champion Garry Kasparov. Last year, another IBM computer, Watson, triumphed at Jeopardy, demonstrating that machines can actually master the subtleties of language. So what's next?
Well, inventor and futurist Ray Kurzweil says soon we'll be able to introduce tiny computers into our bloodstream and brains that will make us healthier, smarter. Here's how he explained that idea to Stephen Colbert on the Colbert Report.
We will have millions of little nanobots keeping us healthy from inside, augmenting our immune system.
So millions of tiny nanobots through our blood system. Is there any way that couldn't turn into a horror movie?
But all kidding aside, Ray Kurzweil is serious. And over the years, he's been seriously right about a lot of other stuff, from predicting the development of the internet and the collapse of the Soviet Union to how long it would take to map the human genome. Now he predicts that in the very near future, artificial intelligence will emulate, even surpass, human abilities.
And he says the new frontier is the human brain. That is, to understand how the brain works, to reverse engineer it, and then apply what we learn to build artificial intelligence machines that are even faster, more powerful, and smarter than us. And given how both hardware and software continue to evolve exponentially, maybe he's right.
At 17, Ray Kurzweil used a computer to compose music. He went on to MIT, invented the first music synthesizer, the first CCD flatbed scanner, and the first print-to-speech reading machine for the blind. He started more than a half dozen successful high-tech companies and has just published How to Create a Mind, The Secret of Human Thought Revealed. And he joins us now. Ray Kurzweil, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Great to be with you, Anthony.
So we're going to get into the specifics of your thesis, which is fascinating. But I want to start at the end, where this would all take us. You know, you're talking about reverse engineering the brain to build artificial intelligence machines that are vastly intelligent. And you argue that will enable us to address all kinds of challenges that we're looking at around the world. What kind of challenges? What does this help us do? Lay out the picture of this brave new world.
Well, intelligence enables us to solve problems. We're already a human-machine civilization. Life expectancy was 20,000 years ago, 200 years ago. Every aspect of our life is enhanced and affected by intelligent machines. We're already a lot smarter than we used to be. I can have a group now of three people in a few weeks do what used to take 100 people years to do. We have already outsourced our memories, historical, personal, cultural memories to our machines. They are making intelligent decisions. Our civilization will grind to a halt if all the intelligent machines stop tomorrow. One of my themes is that this progression is exponential, as you mentioned. Computer hardware doubles in power about every year. The software is progressing even faster. Watson's a very good milestone, and it's not the end. But Watson, playing Jeopardy, had to master, you know, at some level, all of human knowledge. It read all of Wikipedia and can recall any fact in there and within 3 seconds and can deal with the subtleties and vagaries and ambiguities of language. So it's a very impressive milestone. There are many other examples.
So that's what you make reference to this in the introduction of this book, How to Create a Mind, this idea of this exponential growth of human knowledge. You call it technological evolution. You call it the law of accelerating returns, right?
Right. If you measure the basic power, price, performance, capacity of information technology, like computers, communications, genetic sequencing, and there's many other examples, they progress exponentially and predictably. Right now, in computers, as I mentioned, doubling every year. And that's not intuitive. Our intuition about the future is it kind of progresses at the same rate. That's what's hardwired in our brains. But the reality is exponential. If we take 30 steps exponentially, 2, 4, 8, 16, at step 30, you're at a billion. Mm. And indeed, my cell phone is several billion times more powerful per constant dollar in terms of computational capability than the computer I used when I was a student. And we'll do that again in another 25 years. It's also 100,000 times smaller. Mm. It's another exponential progression. And we'll do that. So 25 years from now, you know, computers will be the size of blood cells. We'll be able to introduce them non-invasively, both to keep us healthy and to go inside our brains and expand our thinking directly inside the brain.
And we heard that cut from Stephen Colbert responding to you in the way that Stephen Colbert would. But he raises a potential sort of scary idea about this. Is it scary? Is there a dark side to this kind of evolution of technology?
Well, life is scary, and technology has always been a double-edged sword. I mean, fire kept us warm, cooked our food, but also burned down our villages. And we certainly have seen technologies in the 20th century that have tremendous destructive capability. Take biotechnology. We're using information technology to reprogram our biology away from disease, but the same tools could be used by a bioterrorist to create a super biological weapon. So there is this promise versus peril. I've written extensively about that. Science futures and movies tended to focus on the dystopian negative aspects. It makes for more exciting drama. I take comfort from the fact that intelligent machines today are not just sort of holed up in some dark government laboratory. They're very widely distributed.
So it's a democratizing force even.
Yeah. I mean, a kid in Africa with a smartphone has access to more computation and access to knowledge than the president of the United States did 15 years ago. Hmm. And you see kids with notebook computers do things like start Facebook or start Google. And even high school kids now are doing amazing things with these very inexpensive, widely available tools. So it's very widely distributed, and that's a positive thing. It is literally democratizing. I wrote in the 1980s that the Soviet Union would be swept away by the then-emerging social network, which was sort of early forms of email over teletype machines and fax machines, and people thought that was nuts when I wrote that in the 1980s, but then in the 1990s, that's exactly what happened.
Well, I'd love to talk about this thesis that's in your new book, How to Create a Mind, The Secret of Human Thought Revealed. You write in the introduction, there is now a grand project underway involving thousands of scientists and engineers working to understand the best example we have of an intelligent process, the human brain. And you write that once we understand that, we can use these methods to better understand ourselves, to fix the brain when needed, and the subject of this book, to create even more intelligent machines. So lay this out for us. You present a thesis that you call Pattern Recognition Theory of the Mind, PRTM. What is that, and how does it apply to this effort to build even more intelligent machines?
Well, you listed the three reasons to reverse engineer, which is to say to understand the human brain, to gain more insight into ourselves, to do a better job of fixing it, already putting computers in people's brains like Parkinson's patients, and to use it as biologically inspired methods to create more intelligent machines. It's only recently that we can actually see inside a living brain with enough clarity and detail to not only see the brain create our thoughts, but to see our brain to see our thoughts create our brain. The subtitle of the book is The Secret of Human Thought Revealed, and that is the secret. We create this grand hierarchy of concepts, of patterns in our neocortex, from very primitive patterns like the crossbar and a capital A up to very high-level abstract patterns like she's pretty, that was ironic. And it's all of these concepts are organized in a hierarchy, and we create that hierarchy ourselves with our own thinking. And we lay down one conceptual level at a time. It starts, you know, right at birth or before that. I've got a one-year-old grandson, and he's laid down a few conceptual levels already, and we're still doing it, you know, as adults. We have a certain capacity, though. Basically, the pattern recognition theory of mind states, and I provide the evidence for this, much of which was very recent, came out just as I was sending the book off to the publisher. We have 300 million little modules in the neocortex. That's the part of our brain where we do our thinking, and it's 80% of the brain. And each one recognizes a pattern and then sends that pattern up to a higher level. So one might say, ah, I just saw a crossbar and a capital A, and it goes up to a higher level, and that higher level says, ah, there's a capital A, and it goes to a higher level, and that higher pattern recognizer might say, oh, there's the word apple. Go up another 30 levels, and pattern recognizer goes, well, that was funny. And you might think that those high-level ones are much more sophisticated and complicated than the primitive ones. They're actually the same, but they just exist at, you know, on top of this hierarchy. And the hierarchy is actually formed by actual physical connections of axons and dendrites, and we build that hierarchy with our own thoughts. That's the sort of magic, if you will, of the neocortex. And I describe how it works and all the evidence for it, which comes from multiple sources, from neuroscience, from our own thought experiments. We can look at how the human brain deals with language and other concepts to get some hints as to how it has to work.
There's something, though, very counterintuitive in here that I want to ask you about, and that is, you know, when we think of how to build a computer, I mean, computers are basically, it's easy to explain them. I mean, I know they're much more complicated than this, but they're just very, very fast processors with the right sort of algorithms sort of put in there. The brain, we hear again and again, have always heard, is hugely complicated. Evolved over years and years and years of evolution. Isn't this a highly complex organ upon which to base a computer?
Well, I actually, that's one line of criticism from my thesis, and I deal with it extensively. For example, Paul Allen makes the point that every single connection in the brain has been placed there by evolution to do a specific job, and it's there for a reason. And that's impossible, because there are hundreds of trillions of connections. Where is all that design information? The genome only has about 25 million bytes of design information. There are certain structures in the brain, and they're repeated over and over again. There's enormous redundancy. There's 300 million of these modules, and they're basically the same. The complexity comes when this system interacts with a complex environment and over decades and through very complex experiences and, you know, learning and maturation is, and all of our experiences is part of this process, develops this very complex hierarchy, but it's not part of the design of the brain itself. Each of those modules runs an algorithm. We can describe that. We can, in fact, simulate it. I'm working on that myself now. If you look at a program like Watson, some of the methods it uses are, in fact, very similar to what I'm describing. And it's not actually because those scientists were trying consciously to simulate the human brain. They just found these methods worked, and biological evolution found the same thing. But the 300 million modules, they run basically the same algorithm, and they all process simultaneously, and the sort of unpredictability of human behaviors. You've got 300 million of them operating at the same time. They've all connected themselves in different ways in different people because we've all had different experiences. And so my neocortex and that whole hierarchy that defines my personality, skills, knowledge, memories is different than yours because I've had a lifetime of experience that's unique. I'm not saying it's simple, but it's actually understandable, and I actually describe it in the book, and the average lay reader can understand it, and we can then use that to create intelligent machines.
Well, I want to ask you more about that. First, I want to invite our listeners into this conversation. We're talking to Ray Kurzweil. He's the futurist, inventor, author of The Singularity is Near, and Now, How to Create a Mind, the Secret of Human Thought Revealed. What do you make of his thesis that we can create fabulously powerful computers by reverse engineering our brains? Do you buy it? What questions does it raise in your mind? Give us a call, 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at Radio Boston. Ray Kurzweil, does this mean that we can create machines that can mimic some of the calculations that the brain is capable of? Or are we really getting to a point where these new machines are, I don't know, is clone the right word? You know, true reflections of our brain?
Well, the best examples of AI today use methods that are similar to what goes on in the brain. Watson has different parts to it, but a number of the modules actually work very similarly to what I'm describing. And it's able to do what the human brain does in some ways, in that it can understand very ambiguous, subtle language, some of which actually is very confusing to humans. It got a higher score on Jeopardy than the best two human players in the world put together.
But is it really understanding, or is it manipulating information, you know?
Well, this is a debate. Some people say, oh, it's just doing statistical analysis of words. And as if all it's doing is kind of doing probabilities of word sequences.
Sure.
It's not. It's actually understanding those sentences in the hierarchical fashion that language represents, and uses a whole three-dimensional array of probabilities to assess different possible interpretations. And if that doesn't represent true understanding, then the human brain has no true understanding either, because it works the same way. We assess different probabilities of different interpretations in much the same way that Watson does. And, you know, Watson was able to handle similes and metaphors and jokes and puns. It wasn't perfect, but it also got lots of things right that the humans couldn't get. And it can then apply its level of understanding to a vast amount of material. This is an advantage that computers have. It read all of Wikipedia and several other encyclopedias, 200 million pages of natural language documents that it read. It got its knowledge by reading Wikipedia and these other documents, not by being hand-coded by the scientists with all these facts. And it can then find the right information, resolve ambiguities by, you know, accessing other articles in much the same way a human would. But it can do that at much greater speed. Mm. You and I could read Wikipedia, but we wouldn't remember 95% of it. It remembers everything.
But how far does this take us? Because, I mean, I get it. But you know, the title of the book is How to Create a Mind. And when I think of mind, I'm thinking of everything that comes out of the brain. I mean, the ideas of compassion, of emotion, of the sense of irony, a sense of sarcasm. I mean, I get it.
Those are patterns and concepts that exist at the very highest level of this hierarchy that the neocortex represents. Now, only mammals have a neocortex, and only humans have one that's big enough. The big innovation with Homo sapiens is we have this big forehead that could squeeze in the frontal cortex and give us more neocortex that then could go beyond just meeting our biological needs, and we invented language, and we invented art and science and irony. I mean, other mammals, other primates even don't have irony because they just don't have enough neocortex to get to that level of conceptual understanding. But these are just other concepts that we've been able to master by having, you know, sufficiently powerful neocortex to deal with many different levels of abstraction.
Yeah, but I mean, does the development of vastly more powerful artificial intelligence machines, can we actually get to that point where they're actually able to replicate those kinds of powers of reasoning? I mean, whatever.
Yeah, I mean, that is my main thesis and claim.
Because I have this sense, I have this, and again, I know that you have it, and I just want you, I'm just trying to draw it out because sort of intuitively, I get it that computers can do things faster and faster and faster, but are we really going to, I mean, computers, but are we really going to get to the point where a computer can, I don't know, in spite of all its intelligence, write a novel, comfort a crying baby, for example, something like
that. Well, let me put it this way. If logical intelligence were to the heart of intelligence, then computers are already better than we are. Humans still are superior to computers. So if you talk about today, we can comfort a crying baby or write a novel or a poem or a song, you know, to a much greater extent than machines. By 2029, I believe computers will match that capability. That's been my consistent claim. Watson is not the end of the line, but the fact that it can deal with, in fact, humor and irony in statements is already quite impressive. And people would have thought that was ridiculous if you were to predict that 10 years ago.
So 2029, you've laid some markers down, as we mentioned, over your career, and you've been proved right. So I'm not going to challenge that. Let's get some voices, some other callers into our conversation, though. Masha is calling from Dorchester. Hi, Masha. You're on the air with Ray Kurzweil.
Hi, and hello, Dr. Kurzweil.
Hi.
Are you there?
Yes, we're here.
I'm sorry. I dropped the phone. Anyway, my question is, if the computers become smarter and smarter, isn't there a chance of them becoming smarter than we are? And if they also develop emotions, couldn't they be emotionally motivated to do something that was against our interests and do it in a way that we couldn't keep up with them?
Yeah, well, it's a great question, and certainly there's a lot of science futures and movies.
I'm thinking of HAL and A Space Odyssey, for example.
Show this dystopian side of computers. I would say that if we look at how they're used today, and I believe this is a model for the future, then it's not this alien invasion of smart machines coming from Mars. We create these tools to extend our own reach. We, you know, fashioned a tool 1,000 years ago to reach a higher branch on a tree, and we've been creating more and more sophisticated tools ever since. We now already extend our mental reach with our tools. I believe we're going to use this artificial intelligence to make ourselves smarter. We're going to literally put it inside our bodies and brains and extend our thinking, and it's part of who we are. And we're already a human-machine civilization. It's not man, woman against machine. I think we're all part of the same civilization. But that doesn't mean that it's not dangerous. I mean, certainly military weapons today use artificial intelligence, but you have different groups of humans, both of whom are enhanced by artificial intelligence, fighting each other.
Masha, thanks so much for the call. Let's go to Tom, who's calling from Rockport. Hi, Tom. You're on the air.
Hi. I just have a question. My daughter, at age around 3, developed a neurological disorder that basically caused her to lose comprehension of language and has struggled ever since. And I was wondering whether this nanotechnology potentially would provide benefit, and what sort of time frame we're really looking at.
Ray Kurzweil.
Yeah, well, there's two different technologies that provide significant hope for people with neurological problems like your daughter. One is biotechnology, where we can understand the actual biological genetic triggers which cause diseases like that and really understand how they work and then reprogram them back towards normal health and rejuvenation. A lot of progress is being made in understanding diseases like Parkinson's, even Alzheimer's, and other neurological disorders. And I think it'll be a very different era for that type of technology 10 or 15 years from now. There's many exciting developments in the pipeline now. The other is nanotechnology and artificial intelligence, putting computerized devices in the body and connecting them into the brain or placing them in the brain. You have neural implants already for Parkinson's disease and other neurological conditions where they actually connect electrodes into the brain. The latest neural implants for Parkinson's are now being placed not just in one spot, but in dozens and ultimately hundreds or thousands of different spots. The latest generation allows you to download new software to the neural implant that's connected into your brain from outside the patient. And again, we need to actually understand how these diseases work. So we need to understand human function and dysfunction. That's one of the primary reasons to reverse engineer the brain. So I think we'll have dramatic new treatments, you know, in the next 1 or 2 decades.
Well, brave new world described there by Ray Kurzweil. Ray Kurzweil is the futurist and inventor, and he's the author of his latest book, How to Create a Mind, The Secret of Human Thought Revealed. Ray Kurzweil, it's always fascinating to hear you. Thank you so much for coming in. We appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Ray Kurzweil will be speaking about his book at the Coolidge Corner Theater in Brookline on December 4th at 6 p.m. There's more information and an excerpt from his book on our website, RadioBoston.org. And listeners, you can continue the conversation at RadioBoston.org. Stay with us. Coming up, how human imagination created the meaning behind one of the most famous musical phrases in history. Stay with us. I'm Anthony Brooks with Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.